Coming up on Inside the U.S. Open.
You have more the crowd behind you, so it's more comfortable and it's more familiar from that standpoint. But yes, it is a little bit more pressure, a little bit more excitement, because it means a little more to you to do well at your home slam.
He would have loved to have seen this move into the future with the roof and seeing the event explode into the sporting consciousness in a way that maybe he couldn't have envisioned before he passed away in 1993.
Hi, everyone. It's Nick McCarville, and it is episode 7, our final episode of Inside the U.S. Open. I first off want to thank all of you for listening to the podcast these last couple of weeks. We've done our best to bring you inside the U.S. Open like never before, and I think that we've done just that. Now, we've got a great final episode for you, and it's starting off with a former Grand Slam finalist in Chanda Rubin. She's here as a commentator, and she walks us through what it feels like to be in championship weekend of a Grand Slam. The locker rooms are a little quieter, but there's more pressure on court, and Chanda talks us through just that. Then we get a chance to talk to Steve Flink. He's a tennis journalist and a historian, and we talk about the 20-year anniversary of Arthur Ashe Stadium. The building was built in 1997 for its first U.S. Open, and we're celebrating 20 years of the biggest tennis stadium in the world. Steve talks about his favorite matches and also runs us through what exactly makes Arthur Ashe different, especially now that that arena has a roof. Lastly, our editors have worked their magic, and they've cut us up the best bits of Inside the U.S. Open from the last 2 weeks. So we hear some highlights from what has been this podcast over the last 7 episodes. But first, I asked Chanda Rubin about a doubles final that she made right here at the U.S. Open in 1999 against Serena and Venus Williams.
Lost to Venus and Serena. Darn.
And they're still around.
They're still around, which is great to see.
But you're still around too. Tell us what you've been up to during the U.S. Open this fortnight.
Well, I've been doing some broadcast work. I've continued doing that since I retired. But here in New York, I do that specifically for the U.S. Open broadcast and World Feed.
Very cool. Now, we were just talking about before I hit the record button about finals weekend.
Yes.
And, you know, you, as you mentioned, being in a Grand Slam final, you were in plenty of week twos and singles, quarterfinals, semifinals. What's different about sort of the whole feel of a tournament once you get into championship weekend?
Well, you've gone from a 128 draw, the main draw, and obviously more than that in qualifying, but you've gone from a 128 draw to all of a sudden now it's the final 8 or the final 4 or, you know, the final 2. And the locker room has cleared out a little bit. It's a little quieter. The grounds are still kind of busy and bumping. You feel more energy because the fans are looking forward to the semis and the finals. But it's an interesting contrast because inside the player areas, it's a little more peaceful, and you kind of know and feel like you're one of the last few standing, and it's a great feeling.
I guess if you've been there before, it probably feels familiar, but if you haven't been there before, like we saw with the American girls, who were all, 3 of them, except for Venus, were making their first semifinal appearance at the U.S. Open, it might feel like more pressure, or how does it feel?
Well, I think for playing in your home slam, you certainly feel a little bit more pressure, but it's also just that little more excitement, and you understand, you have the support obviously as well, you have more the crowd behind you, so it's more comfortable and it's more familiar from that standpoint. But yes, it is a little bit more pressure, a little bit more excitement, because it means a little more to you to do well at your home slam. But I think all of these players, you know, regardless of where they are, it's more of the fact that it is 4 American women who are now in the semifinals, who have reached the semifinals, who have played in the semifinals for the U.S. Open. I think that's the bigger story. And it was so impressive when you saw Madison Keys come through. She was the last semifinalist to be penciled in. No pressure at all, right? But to see her come through the way she did. So it's a great story regardless. Yeah. And, of course, there can only be one winner.
Mm. So now let's kind of step back and look at the tournament as a whole. You've been in the booth calling a lot of matches throughout, but we came into this U.S. Open obviously without Serena, and on the men's side we came in without a lot of the top guys. Djokovic, Wawrinka, they were out with injuries. Andy Murray had to pull out last minute. And then the big comeback obviously of Maria Sharapova, which I think took up a lot of headlines for the first week. But now that we're into sort of the business end, what do you look back and you can kind of start to feel what the tournament will feel like maybe in the history books at this point?
I think the first round match, of course, with Maria Sharapova and Simona Halep, I mean, it was amazing. It was, you know, the biggest matchup, first round matchup of the tournament, and the tennis was great. It actually, you know, lived up to what we thought it might be,
and it like exceeded the hype.
Yeah, it
right?
was great for so many reasons. So I think you know, that stood out to me as well. I think the semifinals, the four American women in the semifinals, I mean, that's been a highlight of the tournament, and nobody could have scripted that when it's all started. And certainly to have had Venus in the semifinals again, she has made, I think, 9 of the last 10 rounds of 16. She's made the semifinals in her last 4, I believe, out of 6. So it's been unbelievable to see
in Grand Slams, right?
Grand Slams. Yeah. It's been unbelievable to see her career and the longevity and the fact that she's still inspiring some of these young players. So that was a great story. And Del Potro was a great story as well. I was so impressed with the way he came back to get to the quarters and then taking out Federer the way he did. He's a former champion, and he has just been embraced again by the New York crowds.
Can I ask you, I mean, you know, we talk about this a lot. We talked about it a lot with Serena in 2015. When she was making her run for the Grand Slam. But Venus Williams being 37, and I think some people out there want to say, let's not talk about her age. And she, you know, once again has had a great run at the US Open. But I want to talk about her age because to me it's incredible that 20 years ago, Chanda, she beat Irina Sperlea in the semifinals and gets to the final at 17. And now.
Shoulder bump?
Oh, yes.
we talked about that actually.
That was great.
Because that was the first year we're celebrating 20 years of our Thrash Stadium this year.
That's right.
That was the first year. And here we are 20 years later. She's 37. And Roger, what he did this, what he's done this year, Rafa's in his 30s. Delpo's pushing that age. I mean, we really have seen a change maybe from the generation that you played in of players when they hit 30, they're like, well, maybe I should pull the plug. Now it's the opposite, right?
No, and it's great to see. And it just adds a level of richness to any player's career, their level of expectation in terms of how long they can play, how they can continue to improve and grow. I mean, these are the great parts about seeing examples of athletes like Venus, like Roger, like Rafa, who's a little bit younger, but still at 30, 31, that was considered over the hill 10 years ago. They were looking at you asking when you were going to retire. And you are seeing now these players contend and win Grand Slams. And I think that's the greatest story of all this year in particular, what we've seen and how it's given new life and new hope to players that have come back from injury, that are making a comeback at 31 and 32. We saw Kaia Kanepi. She was a great story, qualified, got to the quarterfinals here. So I think it just adds a whole nother layer and a whole nother area of enjoyment for players and fans, so they can continue to see their favorite players play longer, and players can continue to develop and have chances to win the big titles longer.
You talked about when we started this chat, but the feeling, obviously, of fewer people being around on the final weekend. But when you walk out for a final, now I know you didn't play a Grand Slam singles final, but you played plenty of finals in your career, doubles finals as well. What's the difference? How do you put out? Because there's all the pomp and circumstance, right? There's the flowers and the light show. And at the US Open, we really do things up, which is awesome. But how do you treat this match like any other match that you're playing? Because to me, now I didn't play very good tennis, but I played tennis. And I always felt so much more pressure in a final because it was like, this match means so much more than the other ones. How do you put that out of your mind?
It's difficult, and in some cases you just have to embrace it because it is different. It isn't the first round. It's a final, and you know that you have an opportunity. It's two of you left, and one of you is going to hold up the trophy, and of course you want it to be you. So the more you want something, the more you're going to feel, the more nerves you're going to have, and you can't really deny that. You can't ignore it. The best thing that I found is just to embrace it and then find ways to release it. So you start focusing on the small things that you have to do within the match, which is what you did to get to the final. The little things you have to do on serve, or the little things you do on return every time you go to start a point. I think that's the only way to combat it, because you cannot ignore it and you can't make it go away. Yeah. It's there whether you like it or not. You have to embrace it and you have to be real. And I think as players, you know, get older, I think as they get more experience, they start to embrace that more. And that's why we do see them handling pressure sometimes a little bit better.
Now, regardless of what happens with the American women, you know, when we look back at this tournament, how do you think we're going to see this tournament? Because we were without Serena this year, obviously, but, you know, what the American women did, I kind of find myself at a loss for words in looking at the way that the four semifinalists came through the way that they did.
You know, it's interesting. I think they're... You know, there was a little bit of a letdown sort of when you saw at the beginning of the tournament, you know, with Murray not being there, the defending champion, right, Stan Wawrinka not being there, Raonic, Nishikori, Djokovic, Serena.
Azarenka.
I mean, her story was just, you know, so disappointing that she wasn't able to play. She's on the comeback. But I think... You know, when we look at it sort of from the other end, we'll see some great stories that actually came from it. I mean, the resurgence of a former champion like Juan Martín Del Potro. I think the four American women, that's maybe kind of saved, you know, some of the tournament, yeah, the excitement, certainly, because, you know, that's a story that, you know, can really surpass anything else. I mean, how that the last time that happened for American women in a semifinal, I think was 85. The last time at the U.S. Open was 81.
Yes.
I mean, that's astonishing. So I think that has kind of saved a little bit of the tournament and a little bit. It's refocused a little bit of the excitement, even though you still miss those players and you certainly want to see them back and healthy. So it's a little bittersweet, but I mean, certainly, you know, some great, great momentum and great storylines still.
Okay, last two. What is your favorite thing about the U.S. Open now when you come back to it? And what's a favorite memory for you? Because I know that you have a lot here at the USTA Billie Jean King National Tennis Center.
Hi, my favorite thing about coming back... You're putting me on the spot here. There's so many. I mean, the stuff that I've just enjoyed. But, you know, I think it really is coming back and... just still being a part of the tournament. I mean, it's different not playing. There's no substitute for what you get on court competing and working through matches and that feeling that comes with it. But I think coming back and being a part of it as a commentator and then still seeing some of my old friends and actually playing and playing the legends, you know, so it's sort of coming full circle, and then bringing my daughter back as well now. It's just especially sweet for me because I have so many great memories on court, you know, playing against great players like Venus on Arthur Ashe at night and playing against them in doubles, and it's been unbelievable, and I just cherish those moments and those memories, and, you know, just try to enjoy now from a different side and a different perspective.
Since you called it out, that Arthur, you played Venus in singles, Arthur Ashe at night. How'd that go?
I lost like 7-5 in the third. Oh,
oh
my gosh. I still remember that passing shot. let's not, you know, regress.
I'm sorry to bring it up.
Thank you very much. But, I mean, it's been some great experiences. And, you know, there have been some ups and some downs, yeah, as there are, you know, is in any aspect of life. And I just think I've been fortunate to be able to play this sport. You know, you have the disappointments, but you rise above it and you keep going, you keep moving forward. And there's always joy sort of at the end of the tunnel. And it's, you're constantly getting the chance to recreate, yeah, and, you know, enjoy that creation. So I'm having fun with it.
Did you have fun? This was Chanda Rubin's first ever podcast.
First ever podcast.
It went okay, right?
I think it went unbelievably well. I may be a little biased, but I want to do this again.
You nailed it. You know what? You won this podcast 7-5 in the third.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks, Chanda Rubin, for joining us here on the podcast, her first ever podcast. Very cool. Now, let's turn our attention to the 20-year anniversary of Arthur Ashe Stadium. We're joined by Steve Flink, a tennis journalist and historian. He was also inducted into the International Tennis Hall of Fame this year, which is a big honor for him. But I asked him specifically to dig deep in his memory bank and talk about that first year, 1997, when Arthur Ashe had just opened.
1997 was memorable for two reasons, really. The emergence of Pat Rafter won his first of two straight U.S. Open titles, and that was a major breakthrough for Rafter, who Pete Sampras had been the clear favorite, but he lost to Peter Korda in an epic fifth set tiebreak match, and then that opened the door for Rafter, who was enormously popular with the fans. He was an Aussie, but they loved him. They loved his serve and volley style. That was one major factor in 97. The other was the Venus Williams appearance in the finals, her first final in 1997 and playing against Martina Hingis, who was the dominant figure in women's tennis that year, 16 years old, winning her third major of the year, having reached the finals of the French Open. It was a banner year for Hingis. So Venus was defeated rather decisively in the final, but it was still, we knew that she would someday be a champion here. There was no doubt about that.
Well, and that was the year of Ash's first big controversy, which was the bump, the Venus Williams Irina Spirlea bump.
Absolutely. Right? Had a changeover in the third set in the semifinals. Absolutely right. And Richard Williams made some comments afterwards. And
yes, he did.
And fortunately, it did nobody any harm. I think in a strange way, both Venus and Spirlea were almost amused by it afterwards.
Yeah.
They didn't carry any kind of bad blood over the incident.
Right.
And it made Spirlea as a semifinals more famous than she ever would have been. But that was interesting. And by the way, you think about what a sportswoman Venus Williams has become ever
yeah.
since. You would never have expected her to be involved in that kind of a changeover skirmish. But it was very amusing for everyone and quite a talking point at that stage of the tournament.
Right. So now tell me about first impressions for you going into that stadium and what you felt as a journalist and as a tennis fan.
Yeah, well, I had been a fan and a journalist, obviously, attending all those U.S. Opens at Forest Hills, the first U.S. Open there in 68. They played the first 10 Opens at Forest Hills, so I was used to that intimate stadium at the Westside Tennis Club. Then we came over here to Flushing Meadows and played in Louis Armstrong Stadium, which held about, Forest Hills about 14,000, Louis Armstrong high 18s, near 19.
Wow.
And we thought nothing could be more vast than that. And when you sat at the top of Armstrong, you thought, you can't get any higher than that. And then we knew we would when we came into Ash because it was holding about 23,000 people. So there was always that anticipation of it. I think all of us got acclimated very quickly to the new surroundings. I liked it immediately. I felt that it had a certain flavor to it, and the importance came through of the event. And the fans, even those sitting up at the top sections, they also adjusted. They seemed to like it. I also remember it was sun-splashed because now, of course, there's much more protection from the sun with the advent of the roof. But in those days, there was hardly any, not even a pocket in that stadium that wasn't under the hot, broiling sun frequently throughout the day. And so if you came to Ash, you needed a lot of sunscreen.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and for the players, they needed a lot of patience because of the swirling winds before
yes,
we had the roof.
Yes,
it was the conditions were really tough for the players.
They were the toughest conditions wind-wise of any major by far, because it was the evident day in and day out. You never seemed it was ever evident, and it wouldn't seem to let up. And I think it really made it a, frankly, I think the level of play was diminished at times because of it, because the players had to cope so much with it. But the remarkable memory I have is the 2001 four tiebreaker match, Pete Sampras defeating Andre Agassi, no service breaks for either player in four sets, and they played it in immaculate conditions. For some reason, the wind that night was almost non-existent.
Still.
Just very still evening.
Was that a semifinal?
That was a quarterfinal.
Quarterfinal.
And it was one of the reasons why it was no accident that they played one of their highest quality matches ever, because the conditions were so perfect.
And, yeah.
But that was an anomaly. You just hardly ever got it like that. The wind was always getting in the way.
Okay, so you mentioned that Sampras Agassi 0-1. We've got a lot of classic matches to look back. I mean, you have Todd Martin high-fiving the crowd. You've got ample amount of Serena Williams wins. You've got James Blake and Andre Agassi playing late into the
match.
What are a couple of the ones?
Yeah, the Blake Agassi was a beauty because Blake was
2005?
Yes, exactly. And he blitzed him 3-3 for two sets. You thought he was going to blow Andre right off the court. And eventually Agassi came back and won it somehow in a fifth-set tiebreak. And that was on his way to the finals, which was astonishing at 35 that he would do that. And the Blake win was to him the golden memory of them all, because he had so much respect for Blake and vice versa, and the fans it was a treat for them. And it was also a swiftly moving five set match because Agassi took so little time between points, and same was true of Blake.
Yeah. Now, and also the women, I mean, we've seen so many of the Williams sisters' great matches on that court. Early on, I remember Capriati had a couple great matches. It seemed to, especially at night, the drama of the tennis seems to sort of go up an octave.
It did, because that's when the atmosphere came through. During the day, especially the first week, fans flocked to other courts. They'd go to Armstrong, they'd go to the grandstand, they'd go to the outside court. So unless a top player was on the brink of defeat, they didn't necessarily hang out in the Ash Stadium. But boy, at night, there was no question about it. It was packed. and the fans were they had the undivided attention of the fans, and then I think that's why you had so many memorable matches played under the lights. No accident.
Now, describe for me, if you can, a little bit more on the night sessions, because people who are here at the U.S. Open, I think they get to experience it firsthand. But what does make those night sessions so special? Because Andy Roddick, who you were inducted into the Hall of Fame this year with, he said, full stop, the reason why he played tennis is U.S. Open night session matches.
Yeah. Well, that's because, again, the place you had capacity crowds in there. There might be a lingering match over in Armstrong that started at 6 o'clock that gave them some other option, but by and large, they were here to see stars. They were here to see Roddick. They were here to see Sharapova, Agassi, all of the greats, Sampras, and Federer, because that's that, and a lot of them had worked all day. So you just felt like they were maybe a more appreciative crowd than what we got during the day. And again, the electricity in the place is what emerged at night in a way that it seldom did during the day.
Yeah. So we're obviously talking about Arthur Ashe Stadium. It's 20 years, the 20th anniversary of that stadium. What do you think Mr. Ashe would say about the stadium that his name is attached to, and now it's gone even more futuristic with the roof that made its debut last year?
Yeah, I think he would have been delighted by it all. I think he would have advised them, frankly, in the first place, to put the roof up when they initially built the facility. But in fairness to the USTA, they didn't do it because there were so few, that the weather patterns were consistently so good over the course of the fortnight that they thought it wouldn't be used enough. Then it did start to change, and they realized in those years like 2002 and 3 and 4 when we were having some real wipeout sessions over Labor Day weekend or some other years later when the finals would get delayed, then it was important. But Arthur, I think, would have been thrilled that they named it after him. Proud, because he was the first U.S. Open champion in 1968, winning it at Forest Hills in 5 sets over Tom Ocker. And secondly, he would have loved to have seen this move into the future with the roof and seeing the event explode into the sporting consciousness in a way that maybe he couldn't have envisioned before he passed away in 1993.
Now, lastly, we're moving towards finals weekend. I think the ceremony of the stadium kind of lends to itself, but I think women's primetime final, you know, men's evening-ish final. What's special about this stadium and championship weekend at the Open?
Well, you've been building toward those moments for 2 weeks. And, you know, the first week, everybody is sort of catching bits and pieces of matches. Fans are, the press is. And you're wondering who's going to settle it once and for all at the end. What's it going to come down to? So, and you know also that it's the last major championship of the season in tennis. So it's the last chance for anybody to get on the board. And obviously this year it'll be particularly exciting with all the American women moving on to the semifinals, and then this potential for a Nadal-Federer collision in the semis. So this could end up being one of the more remarkable years we've had at the U.S. Open, especially down the stretch on the final weekend.
Well, and finally, I want to say congratulations to you for being inducted in the International Tennis Hall of Fame this year.
Well, thank you, Nick. I appreciate that
much,
a lot.
Much deserved, and thanks for speaking with us not only about the history of the stadium itself, but the tennis that's played in it.
Well, I'm happy to do it. I'm glad to be with you.
Really great insight there from Steve Flink on the 20 years of Arthur Ashe Stadium. Now, lastly, we've cut up a montage, and we started off with the voice of the U.S. Open. We talked to him earlier in the U.S. Open, Andy Taylor, and let's listen in to him bringing on a couple players onto Arthur Ashe Stadium.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the players for today's next match. From Switzerland, Hendry Laaksonen. And from Argentina, Juan Martín del Potro.
Something you know all too well, Nick, is pronunciation.
Yes.
One of the most challenging aspects of this job, because it's an international event. We don't have Jones and Smith and, you know, Peter and Dave down there. We've got international names. There are oftentimes names are so difficult to pronounce that I'll ask and they'll actually go, oh, for crying out loud, just Americanize it. You've got the doubles player, Michael
Przyzneski, but that's Americanized.
Right. So you say it's Mikhail Przyzne. Przyzne.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, I said he was trying to describe how to pronounce his name to me one time when I was in Doha. And I said, how do I say it? And he's going, Przyzne. So I was saying it. And he said, God bless you. Just say it however you want.
I love watching fantastic tennis. I mean, it's like watching beautiful dancers. Their athleticism is almost, I mean, it's breathtaking, really, in a way. So first and foremost, I like to watch the tennis.
As we're sitting here, the night matches are going to start pretty soon. And it was just so unique because you're sitting in the locker room and it's just you in there. You and your opponent. It feels like a final every time you're stepping onto the court for a night match. And then you get out there in the crowd. The atmosphere is amazing. They're there just to see you. They're not there for any of the outer courts. They're there to see you play. And they're there for you to put on a show.
I love just the feeling of a big event. I love walking around the Open, seeing all the people sitting, enjoying themselves. And I feel like it's a real celebration of New York as well.
If I compare it to the Australian Open now, which is the first tournament of the year, everybody comes super well prepared. They had a great off-season preparation.
It's kind of like back to school, right?
Exactly, yeah. And everybody's excited and you're happy to see all those faces. What have you done? So all these things are super exciting. And then at the US Open, you're like, oh, this guy again, this girl again.
I'm wearing like this super cute jumpsuit right now from Ted Baker. And it's funny because I walk into the locker room and obviously everyone's coming in from practice or from a match, all sweaty. And there I am. I'm like, my pre-match routine involves contouring and highlighting. But nobody's judging me too hard down there because I'm actually there before almost any of the players get there. And it's funny because they walk in and they're like, I feel like we see you everywhere. And then we walk in the locker room and you're the first one we see.
Always everything is like happening there in the city. And even if you go out like so late, like at night, still so many people on the streets. It's something special. And yeah, I really enjoy that this city is like, there's so many things to do and to see. And it's a huge city.
I had a 3 a.m. text from Black Jelly Beans.
Black jelly beans.
Like, hey, Billy, can you get us a bag of black jelly beans? Like licorice. And, you know, what was I going to say? No. So I bought five bags of regular jelly beans and picked out the black ones and gave them the black jelly beans.
No way.
And they took them and thanked me like it was nothing. Cans of Ocean Spray cranberry sauce. We make our own cranberry sauce here. This particular player wanted the Nunberry smooth Ocean Spray cranberry sauce for their turkey.
So Tony Bennett comes every year, and he's so sweet and so lovely. So I've never gotten to see him in concert, but I get to see him live and cook for him every year. And last year, he very sweetly came up to me and he took my elbow and he said, "So, they just keep letting us come back to this thing every year, don't they?" And I thought that was just so awesome.
We just had some cheeseburgers come into the room. You can smell them, right?
I can. They smell nice.
But are you eating cheeseburgers sometimes?
I'm not eating them. I don't know when was my last cheeseburger that I had in, I think Indian Wells, in and out.
Oh, yeah, of course.
You got to try Shake Shack here in New York City.
Yeah, I might.
How is Katie Couric's tennis game?
It's okay. You know, it's okay. I'm strong but inconsistent. You know, I've never played enough to be truly good, but it's a sport that I enjoy. I love the fact that you can play it, you know, until they cart you away or stick you in a nursing home.
Yeah. Well, we're also hanging out with Bobby Jr., who is, how old is he now?
Bobby, how old are you?
3 years old. And does Bobby Jr. play some tennis too?
Bobby Jr. does it all. Bobby, you tennis player? He's doing a little karate.
He's doing some karate
against the wall.
He thinks he's a ninja right now, but I'll get him into it.
I just love how slowly they speak. Yes. And how they pronounce each syllable. Like, hello, everybody. We are here at NPR in Chicago in New York City. I just love the voice. It's so soothing.
I think my goal coming here was really to kind of show everyone the fun side of tennis. All these players that I've gotten to know over the years, competed against. are awesome people. I mean, I'm really inspired by all of them. I'm down there in the trenches with them. I see them working hard up in the gym. I see them getting treatment in the training room. So I know what goes into it. And I'm happy to kind of tell their story in a way from my perspective.
We've gone from 5 TV courts to 12. Next year, we hope to be on all courts with a TV signal. We went from signing off air on our world feed, a day session and night session, to being continually first ball to last ball coverage, so nearly 160 hours of tennis over the 2 weeks. Next year, we're looking at producing all 4 days of qualifying. All of our matches that we produce are available in the States here on ESPN3 as part of the Watch ESPN platform. So that's nearly 1,300 hours of television. When you count up the number of courts and the number of hours that we do each day, that's a lot of television.
I think for me, the best part is just the travel. Being in different places, experiencing tennis in different ways. You know, all four Grand Slams have a completely different atmosphere, a different feel to them, and it makes it, like I've said before, different every day I go to work.
I think one of my favorite moments was working the finals last year. As I work as a net, I bring in the player's bag, and I have to give her the flowers, like, right before she walks in. Oh my gosh, I gave her the flowers. She looked at me, and I was like, good luck. I hope you do well. I grabbed her bag, and I walked in. I don't know if you can ever imagine, like, I don't know how many people are seated in Entourage, but all those people clapping as Kerber's walking in, and I'm right in back of her. I was like, she's number one, but I'm number two right now.
Okay, so are you a tennis player yourself?
Yes.
And what's your best shot?
Forehand.
Do you have a forehand like Rafa's?
Yeah.
Yeah? What grade are you in?
I'm going into second grade.
Second grade. And are we going to see you here at the U.S. Open one day playing?
Maybe.
As usual, I owe a big thanks to our guests for this episode, Chanda Rubin and to Steve Flink. And then a big thanks to my editors for pulling together the best bits of what has been a great first season of Inside the US Open. If you have missed an episode, go to Audio Boom, to Apple Podcasts, or you can also head to usopen.org and go to the social section. That's where the podcast lives now and forever. And I hope that you've all enjoyed looking inside the US Open and getting behind the scenes tour on this podcast the last couple weeks. My name is Nick McCarville. Thanks for having a listen, and we hope to talk to you again soon.